30. Arkady came back in the late afternoon, tired and worried. He showered, wrote up some notes, and lay on his bunk. The visit to Titus had not gone well. No, that is not true. He and Titus had got on very well, but what Titus had to tell him was a depressing story. Titus's father was Pintupi, his mother was Laricha, and he was 47 or 48 years old. He had been born not far from his shanty, but around 1942, attracted by the white man's jam, tea and flour. His parents had migrated out of the desert and taken refuge at the Lutheran mission on Horn River. The pastors recognized in Titus a child of outstanding intelligence and took him for education. Even as late as the 1950s, the Lutherans ran their schools on the lines of a Prussian academy, and Titus was a model pupil. There are pictures of him at his desk, his hair neatly parted, in grey flannel shorts and spit-and-polished shoes. He learned to speak fluent English and German. He learned calculus. He mastered all kinds of mechanical skills. As a young lay preacher, he once astonished his teachers by delivering a sermon, in German, on the theological consequences of the Edict of Worms. Twice a year, in June and again in November, he would get out his double-breasted suit, board the train for Adelaide, and spend a few weeks catching up with modern life. In the public library, he would read back numbers of Scientific American. One year, he took a course in petrochemical technology. The other Titus was the ultra-conservative song man, who lived half-naked with his dependents and his dogs, who hunted with a spear and never a rifle, who spoke 6 or 7 Aboriginal languages and was famous up and down the Western Desert for his judgments on tribal law. To have the stamina to keep both systems going was proof, if proof were lacking, of an incredible vitality. Titus had welcomed the Land Rights Act as a chance for his people to go back to their country and their only hope of getting rid of alcoholism. He detested the activities of the mining companies. Under the Act, the government reserved the right to all minerals under the ground and to grant licenses for prospecting, yet the companies, if they wished to make soundings in Aboriginal country, were at least obliged to consult the traditional owners and, if mining operations started, to pay them a royalty. Titus, after weighing the pros and cons, took the line that money from minerals was bad money, bad for whites and bad for blacks. It had corrupted Australia and given it false values and false standards of living. When a company got permission to put seismic lines through his country, he gave them the scorn of his passive non-cooperation. This attitude was not calculated to win him friends, either among white businessmen or ambitious blacks in Alice. It was also the reason for the present dispute. Around 1910, Titus's grandfather, in dealings with the Laricha clan, who, now living on the Amadeus mission, called themselves the Amadeus Mob, had exchanged 2 sets of unmarked Turingas. The exchange gave each the right of access to the other's hunting ground. Since the Turingas had never been returned, the agreement was still in force. One day, at a time when the mining company despaired of dealing with Titus, a deputation from Amadeus turned up in Alice to say that they, not he, were the owners of the country and its songs, and were therefore entitled to mining royalties. What they had done was to tamper with the Turingas, engraving them with their own totemic designs. They had, in other words, forged the title deeds to Titus's birthright. Titus, who knew of Arkady by reputation only, had sent a message for help. Arkady, at his briefing in Alice, had been assured that this was simply a squabble about money. But Titus, it turned out, didn't give a hoot for money. The crisis was much more dangerous, since by altering the Turingas, the Amadeus mob had attempted to rewrite the creation. Titus told Arkady how at nights he heard his ancestors howling for vengeance, and how he felt forced to obey them. Arkady, for his part, realized the urgency of getting the offenders to withdraw their sacrilege, but could only think of playing for time. He suggested Titus take a holiday in Alice. "No," said Titus grimly, "I'll stay." "Then promise me one thing," Arkady said. "Do nothing until I get back to you."
"I promise."
Arkady was sure he meant to keep the promise, but what he found so shocking was the idea that, from now on, Aboriginals themselves were going to twist their own law in order to line their pockets. "And if that's going to be the future," he said, "I might as well give up." That evening, Estrella insisted on cooking an estofado for the roofing man, and while we were waiting in her caravan, we heard a few pecks of rain on the roof. I looked out to see, hanging over Mount Liebler, a solid barrage of cloud with bolts of lightning fizzling at the edges. A few minutes later, the storm broke in sheets of water. "Christ," said Arkady, "we'll be bogged in here for weeks." "I'd like that," I said.
"Would you?" he snapped. "I wouldn't."
First there was the Titus business to attend to, then there was Hanlon, then Arkady was due in Darwin in 4 days' time for a meeting with the railway engineer.
"You never told me," I said. "You never asked."
The trip switch of the generator then failed, and we were left in semi-darkness. The rain slammed down for half an hour or so and stopped as abruptly as it started. I went outside. "Ark," I called, "you must come out." A pair of rainbows hung across the valley between the two mountains. The cliffs of the escarpment, which had been a dry red, were now purplish black and striped, like a zebra, with vertical shoots of white water. The cloud seemed even denser than the earth, and beneath its lower rim, the last of the sun broke through, flooding the spinifex with shafts of pale green light.
"I know," said Arkady, "like nowhere else in the world."
It poured again in the night. Next morning, before light, he shook me awake.
"We've got to get going," he said, "quick."
He had listened to the weather forecast. There was worse weather on the way.
"Must we?" I said sleepily. "I must," he said. "You stay if you want."
"No," I said, "I'll come." We had tea and tidied the caravan. We wiped the mud stains from the floor and scribbled a note for Wendy and Rolf. We drove off through the puddles along the airstrip and joined the road that comes from Lake Mackay. The dawn was murky and sunless. We came off a ridge of higher ground, and the road disappeared into a lake.
"Well, that," said Arkady, "is that."
It was pouring by the time we got back to Cullen. Rolf was standing outside the store in a rainproof poncho.
"Ah," he leered at me, "thought you could sneak off without saying goodbye. I haven't done with you yet."
Arkady spent the rest of the morning on the radio. The reception was terrible. All the roads to Alice were closed and would be for at least 10 days. There were 2 seats on the mail plane, if the pilot would only make a detour. Around noon there was a message that the plane would try to land.
"You coming?" said Arkady.
"No," I said. "I'll stay."
"Good for you," he said. "Make sure the kids don't monkey around with the Land Cruiser."
He parked the vehicle under the trees by our caravan and handed me the key. At the dispensary, Estrella had a woman in agony with an abscess. She would have to go to hospital in Alice and would have to have my seat on the plane. Another storm seemed to be brewing behind Mount Liebler when the crowd began waving at a black speck coming from the south. The Cessna splashed down onto the runway, spattering the fuselage with mud, and taxied towards the store.
"Get a fucking move on," the pilot bawled from the cockpit.
Arkady gripped my hand.
"See you, mate," he said. "About 10 days, if all goes well."
"See you," I said.
"Bye-bye, little monster," he said to Rolf,
and escorted the moaning woman to the plane. They took off, easing out of the valley just ahead of the incoming storm.
"How does it feel," Rolf asked, "to be stuck here with me?"
"I'll survive."
For lunch we had a beer and a salami sandwich. The beer made me sleepy, so I slept until 4. When I woke, I started rearranging the caravan as a place to work in. There was a plyboard top which pulled out over the second bunk to make a desk. There was even a swivelling office chair. I put my pencils in a tumbler and my Swiss Army knife beside them. I unpacked some exercise pads, and with the obsessive neatness that goes with the beginning of a project, I made 3 neat stacks of my Paris notebooks. In France, these notebooks are known as carnet moleskine, moleskin in this case being its black oilcloth binding. Each time I went to Paris, I would buy a fresh supply from a papeterie in the Rue de l'Ancienne Comédie. The pages were squared and the end papers held in place with an elastic band. I had numbered them in series. I wrote my name and address on the front page, offering a reward to the finder. To lose a passport was the least of one's worries. To lose a notebook was a catastrophe. In 20-odd years of travel, I lost only two. One vanished on an Afghan bus, the other was filched by the Brazilian secret police, who, with a certain clairvoyance, imagined that some lines I had written about the wounds of a Baroque Christ were a description in code of their own work on political prisoners. Some months before I left for Australia, the owner of the papeterie said that the vrai moleskine was getting harder and harder to get. There was one supplier, a small family business in Tours. They were very slow in answering letters. "I'd like to order 100," I said to Madame. 100 will last me a lifetime." She promised to telephone Tours at once that afternoon. At lunchtime I had a sobering experience. The head waiter of Brasserie Lip no longer recognized me.
"Non, monsieur, il n'y a pas de place."
At 5 I kept my appointment with Madame. The manufacturer had died. His heirs had sold the business. She removed her spectacles and, almost with an air of mourning, said,
"Le vrai moleskine n'est plus."
I had a presentiment that the travelling phase of my life might be passing. I felt, before the malaise of settlement crept over me, that I should reopen those notebooks. I should set down on paper a resume of the ideas, quotations, and encounters which had amused and obsessed me, and which I hoped would shed light on what is, for me, the question of questions, the nature of human restlessness. Pascal, in one of his gloomier pensées, gave it as his opinion that all our miseries stemmed from a single cause, our inability to remain quietly in a room. Why, he asked, must a man with sufficient to live on feel drawn to divert himself on long sea voyages, to dwell in another town, to go off in search of a peppercorn, or go off to war and break skulls? Later, on further reflection, having discovered the cause of our misfortunes, he wished to understand the reason for them. He found one very good reason, namely, the natural unhappiness of our weak mortal condition, so unhappy that when we gave to it all our attention, nothing could console us. One thing alone could alleviate our despair, and that was distraction, divertissement. Yet this was the worst of our misfortunes, for in distraction we were prevented from thinking about ourselves and were gradually brought to ruin. Could it be, I wondered, that our need for distraction, our mania for the new, was, in essence, an instinctive migratory urge akin to that of birds in autumn? All the great teachers have preached that man, originally, was a wanderer in the scorching and barren wilderness of this world. The words are those of Dostoevsky's Grand Inquisitor, and that to rediscover his humanity, he must slough off attachments and take to the road. My two most recent notebooks were crammed with jottings taken in South Africa, where I had examined at first hand certain evidence of the origin of our species. What I learned there, together with what I now knew about the song lines, seemed to confirm the conjecture I had toyed with for so long. The natural selection has designed us, from the structure of our brain cells to the structure of our big toe, for a career of seasonal journeys on foot through a blistering land of thorn scrub or desert. If this were so, if the desert were home, if our instincts were forged in the desert to survive the rigours of the desert, then it is easier to understand why greener pastures pall on us, why possessions exhaust us, and why Pascal's imaginary man found his comfortable lodgings a prison. From the Notebooks. Our nature lies in movement. Complete calm is death. Pascal, Pensée. A study of the great malady, horror of home. Baudelaire, Journaux Intimes. The most convincing analysts of restlessness were often men who, for one reason or another, were immobilized. Pascal by stomach ailments and migraines, Baudelaire by drugs, St. John of the Cross by the bars of his cell. There are French critics who would claim that Proust, the hermit of the cork-lined room, was the greatest of literary voyagers. The founders of monastic rule were forever devising techniques for quelling wanderlust in their novices. A monk out of his cell, said St. Anthony, is like a fish out of water. yet Christ and the apostles walked their journeys through the hills of Palestine. What is this strange madness? Petrarch asked of his young secretary, this mania for sleeping each night in a different bed. What am I doing here? Rombo, writing home from Ethiopia. Picos, Piauí, Brazil. Sleepless night in the Charm Hotel. The sleeping sickness bug is endemic to this region, which has one of the highest infant mortality rates in the world. At breakfast time, the proprietor, instead of serving my eggs, thwacked his fly swat onto my plate and removed a mottled brown insect by the leg.
Mata gente, he said gloomily. It kills people.
The stucco facade is painted a pale mint green, with the words Charm Hotel in bold black letters. A leaking gutter pipe has washed away the letter C, so that it now reads... Jiang, Cameroon. There are two hotels in Jiang, the Hotel Windsor, and across the street, the Hotel Anti-Windsor. British Embassy, Kabul, Afghanistan. The third secretary is also cultural attaché. His office is stacked with copies of Orwell's Animal Farm. The British government's contribution to the teaching of English in Afghan schools, and an elementary lesson on the evils of Marxism, as voiced through the mouth of a pig. But pigs, I said, in an Islamic country, don't you think that kind of propaganda might backfire? The cultural attaché shrugged. The ambassador thought it was a good idea. There was nothing he could do. He who does not travel does not know the value of men. Moorish proverb. Miami, Florida. On the bus from downtown to the beach, there was a lady in pink. She must have been 80 at least. She had bright pink hair with pink flowers in it, a matching pink dress, pink lips, pink nails, pink handbag, pink earrings, and in her shopping basket there were boxes of pink Kleenex. In the wedges of her clear plastic heels, a pair of goldfish were lazily floating in formaldehyde. I was too intent on the goldfish to notice the midget in horn-rimmed glasses who was standing on the seat beside me.
"Permit me to ask you, sir," he asked in a squeaky voice, "which of the human qualities do you value the most?"
"I haven't thought," I said.
"I used to believe in empathy," he said, "but I have recently moved over to compassion."
"I'm glad to hear it."
"Permit me to ask you, sir, at which of the professions are you presently engaged?"
"I'm studying to be an archaeologist."
"You amaze me, sir. I'm in that line of country myself."
He was a sewer rat. His friends would lower him, with a metal detector, into the main sewer beneath the hotels of Miami Beach. There he would prospect for jewellery flushed accidentally down the toilets.
"It is not, I can assure you, sir," he said, "an unrewarding occupation."
On the night express from Moscow to Kiev, reading Donne's third elegy, to live in one land is captivity, to run all countries a wild roguery. This life is a hospital in which each sick man is possessed by a desire to change beds. One would prefer to suffer by the stove, another believes he would recover if he sat by the window. I think I would be happy in that place I happen not to be, and this question of moving house is the subject of a perpetual dialogue I have with my soul. Baudelaire, Anywhere Out of This World. Bacom, Cameroon. The names of taxis. The confidence car. Baby confidence. The return of the gentleman chauffeur. Le chauffeur kamikaze. In the air, Paris-Dakar. Dinner last night at the Rue L'Abbé de l'Épée. Malraux was there. A ventriloquist. He gave a faultless imitation of the door to Stalin's office as it slammed in Gide's face. He and Gide had gone to complain about the treatment of homosexuals in Russia, and Stalin had got wind of their intention. Dakar. The Hotel Coq Hardy is also a brothel. Its owner, Madame Martine, owns a fishing boat, and so we have langoust for dinner. Of the two resident whores, my friend, Mademoiselle Yo-Yo, wears a mountainous puce-pink turban and has piston rods for legs. The other, Madame Jacqueline, has two regular clients, Herr Kisch, a hydrologist, and the ambassador of Mali.
Yesterday was Kish night. She appeared on her balcony, bangled and gleaming, the mother of all Africa, in flowing robes of indigo. She blew him a kiss, tossed down a sprig of bougainvillea, and cooed, "Herr Kish, I come." Tonight, when the ambassador's Mercedes pulled up outside, she flew out in a curvaceous café au lait suit, a peroxide wig, and white high-heeled shoes, shouting stridently, "Monsieur l'ambassadeur, je viens!" Gorée, Senegal. On the terrace of the restaurant, a fat French couple have been stuffing themselves with fruits de mer. Their dachshund, leashed to the woman's chair leg, keeps jumping up in the hope of being fed. Woman to dachshund, "Taisez-vous, Romeo, c'est l'entracte." Internal burning. Wandering fever. Kalevala. In The Descent of Man, Darwin notes that in certain birds the migratory impulse is stronger than the maternal. A mother will abandon her fledglings in the nest rather than miss her appointment for the long journey south. Sydney Harbour. On the ferry back from Manly, a little old lady heard me talking. "You're English, aren't you?" she said, in an English North Country accent. "I can tell you're English." "I am." "So am I." She was wearing thick steel-framed spectacles and a nice felt hat with a wisp of blue net above the brim. "Are you visiting Sydney?" I asked her. "Lord love, no," she said. "I've lived here since 1946. I came out to live with my son, but a very strange thing happened. By the time the ship got here, he'd died. Imagine, I'd given up my home in Doncaster, so I thought I might as well stay. So I asked my second son to come out and live with me. So he came out, emigrated, and do you know what?"
"No."
"He died. He had a heart attack and died."
"That's terrible," I said.
"I had a third son," she went on. "He was my favourite, but he died in the war. Dunkirk, you know. He was very brave. I had a letter from his officer. Very brave he was. He was on the deck, covered in blazing oil, and he threw himself into the sea. Ooh, he was a sheet of living flame."
"But that is terrible."
"But it's a lovely day," she smiled. "Isn't it a lovely day?"
It was a bright, sunny day with high white clouds and a breeze coming in off the ocean. Some yachts were beating out towards the heads, and other yachts were running under spinnaker. The old ferry ran before the Whitecaps, towards the opera house and the bridge.
"And it's so lovely out at Manly," she said. "I loved to go out to Manly with my son before he died, but I haven't been for 20 years.
"But it's so near," I said.
"But I haven't been out of the house for 16. I was blind, love. My eyes was covered with cataracts and I couldn't see a thing. The eye surgeon said it was hopeless. So I sat there. Think of it, 16 years in the dark. Then along comes this nice social worker the other week and says, we'd better get those cataracts looked at. And look at me now."
I looked through the spectacles at a pair of twinkling, that is the word for them, twinkling blue eyes.
"They took me to hospital," she said, "and they cut out the cataracts. And isn't it lovely? I can see."
"Yes," I said, "it's wonderful."
"It's my first time out alone," she confided. "I didn't tell a soul. I said to myself at breakfast, it's a lovely day. I'll take the bus to Circular Quay and go over on the ferry to Manly, just like we did in the old days. I had a fish lunch. Oh, it was lovely."
She hunched her shoulders mischievously and giggled.
"How old would you say I was?" she asked.
"I don't know," I said. "Let me look at you. I'd say you were 80.
"No, no, no," she laughed. "I'm 93, and I can see."
Darwin quotes the example of Audubon's goose, which, deprived of its pinion feathers, started out to walk the journey on foot. He then goes on to describe the sufferings of a bird penned up at the season of its migration, which would flail its wings and bloody its breast against the bars of its cage. Robert Burton, sedentary and bookish Oxford don, devoted an immense amount of time and scholarship to showing that travel was not a curse, but a cure for melancholy, that is, for the depressions brought on by settlement. "The heavens themselves run continually round, the sun riseth and sets, the moon increaseth, stars and planets keep their constant motions, the air is still tossed by the winds, the waters ebb and flow, to their conservation, no doubt, to teach us that we should ever be in motion." Or, There is nothing better than a change of air in this malady, melancholia, than to wander up and down, as those Tartari Zalmohenses that live in hordes, and take the opportunity of times, places, seasons. The anatomy of melancholy. My health was menaced. Terror came. For days on end I fell asleep, and when I woke, the dark dreams continued. I was ripe for death. My debility led me along a route of dangers, to the world's edge, to Cimmeria, the country of black fog and whirlwinds. I was forced to travel, to ward off the apparitions assembled in my brain. Rambo, Une Saison en Enfer. He was a great walker, oh, an astonishing walker, his coat open, a little fez on his head in spite of the sun. Riga on Rambo in Ethiopia. Along horrible tracks, like those presumed to exist on the moon. Rambo, writing home. L'homme aux semelles de vent, the man with footsoles of wind. Verlaine on Rambo. Omdurman, Sudan. Sheikh S. lives in a small house overlooking the tomb of his grandfather, the Mahdi. On sheets of paper joined with scotch tape to make a scroll, he has written a poem of 500 stanzas, in the style and meter of Gray's Elegy, entitled Lament for the Destruction of the Sudanese Republic. He has been giving me lessons in Arabic. He says I have the light of faith on my forehead, and hopes to convert me to Islam. I say I will convert to Islam, if only he will conjure up a djinn. Djinns, he says, are difficult, but we can try. After an afternoon of combing the Omdurman souk for the right kinds of myrrh, frankincense, and perfume, we are now all prepared for the djinn. The faithful have prayed, the sun has gone down, and we are sitting in the garden under a papaya in a mood of reverent expectation in front of a charcoal brazier. The sheikh first tries a little myrrh. A wisp of smoke curls upward. No gin. He tries the frankincense. No gin. He tries everything we have bought, in turn. Still no gin. He then says, let's try the Elizabeth Arden. Nouakchott, Mauritania. An ex-legionnaire, a veteran of Dien Bien Phu, with grey hair en brosse and a toothy grin, is outraged at the US government for avoiding the blame for the My Lai massacre. There is no such thing as a war crime, he said. War is the crime. He is even more outraged by the court sentence that condemned Lieutenant Kali for the murder of human Orientals, as if Oriental needed human to qualify it. His definition of a soldier is as follows: a professional man who for 30 years is employed to kill other men. After that he prunes his roses. Above all, do not lose your desire to walk. Every day I walk myself into a state of well-being and walk away from every illness. I have walked myself into my best thoughts, and I know of no thought so burdensome that one cannot walk away from it. But by sitting still, and the more one sits still, the closer one comes to feeling ill, thus if one just keeps on walking, everything will be all right. Søren Kierkegaard, Letter to Jette, 1847. Solvitur ambulando. It is solved by walking. Attar, Mauritania. Have you seen the Indians? Asked the son of the emir of Adra. I have. Is it a village or what? No, I said. It is one of the greatest countries in the world. Tiens, I always thought it was a village. Nukasho, Mauritania. A scatter of concrete buildings dumped down in the sand and now surrounded by a bidonville of nomads who, like Jacob and his sons, have been forced into settlement when the famine was sore in the land. Until last year's drought, about 80% of the people in this country lived in the tents. The Moors have a passion for the colour blue. Their robes are blue. Their turbans are blue. The tents of the bidonville are patched with blue cotton. And the shanties, cobbled together from packing cases, are bound to have some blue paint somewhere. This afternoon I followed a wizened old crone who was picking over the garbage dump in search of blue rag. She picked up one piece, she picked up another, she compared them. She chucked the first piece away. At last she found a scrap which was exactly the shade she was looking for, and she went away singing. On the edge of town, three tiny boys stopped booting their football and ran up to me, but instead of asking for money or my address, the tiniest began a very grave conversation. What was my opinion of the war in Biafra? What were the causes of the Arab-Israeli conflict? What did I think of the persecution of the Jews by Hitler, the pharaonic monuments of Egypt, the ancient empire of the Almoravids? But who, I asked, are you? He saluted stiffly.
Sal, Zachariah Sal Mohammed, he trilled in a high-pitched treble, son of the Minister of the Interior.
And how old are you?
8.
Next morning a jeep arrived to take me to the minister.
I believe, cher monsieur, he said, that you have met my son. A most interesting conversation, he tells me. I, for my part, would like you to dine with us, and to know if I can assist you in any way.
For a long time, I prided myself I would possess every possible country.
Rambo, une saison en enfer.
Mauritania, on the road to Attar. There were about 50 people on top of the truck, huddled against sacks of grain. We were halfway to Attar when a sandstorm hit. Next to me was a strong-smelling Senegalese. He said he was 25. He was stocky and over-muscled, and his teeth were orange from chewing cola nuts.
You are going to Attar? He asked.
You too?
No, I am going to France.
What for?
To continue my profession.
What is your profession?
Installation sanitaire.
You have a passport?
No, he grinned, I have a paper.
He unfolded a soggy scrap of paper on which I read that Don Hernando so-and-so, master of the trawler such-and-such, had employed Amadou, surname blank, etc., etc.
I will go to Villa Cisneros, he said. I will take a ship to Tenerife or Las Palmas in the Gran Canaria. There I will continue my profession.
As a sailor?
No, monsieur, as an adventurer. I wish to see all the peoples and all the countries of the world.
On the road back from Attar, there were 15 passengers crammed into the back of a canvas-hooded pickup. All of them were Moors, except for myself and a person covered in a sack. The sack moved, and the drawn and beautiful head of a young Wolof peered out. His skin and hair were coated with white dust, like the bloom on purple grapes. He was frightened and very upset.
"What's the matter?" I asked. "It is finished. I was turned back at the frontier."
Where were you going?
To France.
What for?
To continue my profession.
What is your profession?
You would not understand.
I would, I said.
I know most of the métiers in France.
No, he shook his head.
This is not a profession that you would understand.
Tell me. Finally, with a sigh that was also a groan, he said,
I am an ébéniste. I make bourreau plat, Louis XV, and Louis XVI.
This he did. In Abidjan, he had learned to inlay veneer at a furniture factory that catered to the taste of the new black Francophile bourgeoisie. Although he had no passport, he had in his bag a book on French 18th-century furniture. His heroes were Cresson and Reisner. He had hoped to visit the Louvre, Versailles, and the Musée des Arts Décoratifs. He had hoped, if possible, to apprentice himself to a Parisian master, assuming that such a person existed. London. With Bertie, to a dealer in French furniture, the dealer had offered a Reisner commode to Paul Getty, who had called on Bertie for his expertise. The commode had been over-restored to its original condition. Bertie looked at it and said, "Oh."
"Well," asked the dealer after a long pause, "well, I wouldn't put it in the maid's bedroom, but it'll do for him."
It is good to collect things, but it is better to go on walks. Anatole, France. My possessions fly away from me like locusts. They are on the wing, flying. A lament on the destruction of Ur. Timbuktu. The waiter brought me the menu.
Capitaine Bamakois,
fried catfish.
Pintade grillée, dessert.
Good, I said. What time can I eat?
We eat at 8, he said.
All right, then, 8.
No, monsieur, we eat at 8. You must eat before 7 or after 10.
Who's we?
We, he said, the staff.
He lowered his voice and whispered,
I counsel you to eat at 7, monsieur. We eat up all the food.
Christianity was planted here about a century ago, not personally, by Cardinal de la Vigarie, Archbishop of Carthage and Primate of all Africa. He was a connoisseur of Burgundy, and had his habits made at Worth. Among his agents in Africa were three white fathers, Pommier, Berlin, and Minoret, who, shortly after saying Mass in the Forbidden City, had their heads struck off by the Tuareg. The Cardinal received the news in his landau on the seafront at Biarritz.
"Te Deum laudamus," he cried, "but I don't believe it."
"No," said his informant, "it's true."
"They are really dead?"
"They are.
What joy for us and for them."
The Cardinal interrupted his morning drive to write three identical letters of condolence to the mothers. "God used you to give them birth, and God used me to send them as martyrs to heaven. You have that happy certainty." In a paperback copy of Tristram Shandy, bought in the second-hand bookstore in Alice, this was scribbled in the flyleaf. "One of the few moments of happiness a man knows in Australia is that moment of meeting the eyes of another man over the tops of two beer glasses." Yunnan, China. The village schoolmaster was a chivalrous and energetic man with a shock of glinting blue-black hair who lived with his childlike wife in a wooden house beside the Jade Stream. A musicologist by training, he had climbed to distant mountain villages to record the folk songs of the Naki tribe. He believed, like Vico, that the world's first languages were in song. Early man, he said, had learnt to speak by imitating the calls of animals and birds, and had lived in musical harmony with the rest of creation. His room was crammed with bric-a-brac, salvaged, heaven knows how, from the catastrophes of the Cultural Revolution. Perched on chairs of red lacquer, we nibbled melon seeds while he poured into thimbles of white porcelain a mountain tea known as Handful of Snow. He played us a tape of a Naki chant, sung antiphonally by men and women around the bier of a corpse. "Woo-zee, woo-zee." The purpose of the song was to drive away the eater of the dead, a fanged and malicious demon thought to feast upon the soul. He surprised us by his ability to hum his way through the mazurkas of Chopin and an apparently endless repertoire of Beethoven. His father, a merchant in the Lhasa caravan trade, had sent him in the 1940s to study Western music at the Kunming Academy. On the back wall, above a reproduction of Claude Lorraine's L'Embarquement pour Cider, were two framed photos of himself, one in white tie and tails behind a concert grand, the other conducting an orchestra in a street of flag-waving crowds, a dashing and energetic figure on tiptoe, his arms extended upwards and his baton down. 1949, he said, to welcome the Red Army into Kunming. What were you playing? Schubert's Marche Militaire. For this, or rather for his devotion to Western culture, he got 21 years in jail. He held up his hands, gazing at them sadly, as though they were long-lost orphans. His fingers were crooked and his wrists were scarred, a reminder of the day when the guards strung him up to the roof beams in the attitude of Christ on the cross or a man conducting an orchestra. One commonly held delusion is that men are the wanderers and women the guardians of hearth and home. This can, of course, be so, but women above all are the guardians of continuity. If the hearth moves, they move with it. It is the gypsy women who keep their men on the road. Similarly, in the gale-lashed waters of the Cape Horn archipelago, it was the women of the Yaghan Indians who kept their embers alight in the bottom of their bark canoes. The missionary father, Martin Gusinder, compared them to the ancient Vestals, or to fidgety birds of passage who were happy and inwardly calm only when they were on the move. In Central Australia, women are the driving force behind the return to the old ways of life. As one woman said to a friend of mine, "Women are ones for country." Mauritania. 2 days out from Shingeti, we had to cross a gloomy grey canyon with not a green thing in sight. On the valley floor there were several dead camels, their desiccated hides flopping rat, tat, tat against the rib cages. It was almost dark by the time we'd climbed the opposite cliff. A sandstorm was brewing. The camels were restless, One of the guides then pointed to some tents, three of goat hair and one of white cotton, about half a mile away among the dunes. We approached slowly. The guides screwed up their faces, trying to decide if the tents were of a friendly tribe. Then one of them smiled, said, "Lalachlal," and put his camels into a trot. A tall young man drew back the tent flap and beckoned us forward. We dismounted. His robes were blue, and he was wearing yellow slippers. An old woman brought us dates and goat's milk, and the sheik gave orders for a kid to be killed. "Nothing has changed," I said to myself, "since the days of Abraham and Sarah." The sheik, Sidi Ahmed el-Beshir Hamadi, spoke perfect French. After supper, as he poured the mint tea, I asked him naively why life in the tents, for all its hardship, was irresistible.
"Bah," he shrugged, "I'd like nothing better than to live in a house in town. Here in the desert you can't keep clean, you can't take a shower. It's the women who make us live in the desert. They say the desert brings health and happiness to them and to the children."
Timbuktu. The houses are built of grey mud. Many of the walls are covered with graffiti, written in chalk, in the neatest of copybook hands.
"Les noms de ceux qui voyagent dans la nuit sont Sidi et Yeye.
Et là, les anges de l'enfer. Beauté, beau.
La poussière en décembre."
Useless to ask a wandering man advice on the construction of a house. The work will never come to completion. After reading this text from the Chinese Book of Odes, I realized the absurdity of trying to write a book on nomads. Psychiatrists, politicians, tyrants are forever assuring us that the wandering life is an aberrant form of behavior, a neurosis, a form of unfulfilled sexual longing, a sickness which, in the interests of civilization, must be suppressed. Nazi propagandists claimed that gypsies and Jews, people with wandering in their genes, could find no place in a stable Reich. Yet, in the East, they still preserve the once universal concept that wandering re-establishes the original harmony which once existed between man and the universe. There is no happiness for the man who does not travel. Living in the society of men, the best man becomes a sinner, for Indra is the friend of the traveller, therefore wander.
Aitareya Brahmana. You cannot travel on the path before you have become the path itself. Gautama Buddha.
Walk on.
His last word to his disciples. In Islam, and especially among the Sufi orders, siyahat, or errance, the action or rhythm of walking, was used as a technique for dissolving the attachments of the world and allowing men to lose themselves in God. The aim of a dervish was to become a dead man walking, one whose body stays alive on the earth, yet whose soul is already in heaven. A Sufi manual, the Kashf al-Mahjub, says that towards the end of his journey the dervish becomes the way, not the wayfarer, i.e., a place over which something is passing, not a traveller following his own free will. Arkady, to whom I mentioned this, said it was quite similar to an aboriginal concept. Many men afterwards become country in that place, ancestors. By spending his whole life walking and singing his ancestor's songline, a man eventually became the track, the ancestor, and the song. The wayless way, where the sons of God lose themselves and at the same time find themselves. Meister Eckhart. He is by nature led to peace so perfect that the young behold with envy what the old man hardly feels. Wordsworth, Old Man Travelling. A very brief life of Diogenes. He lived in a tub. He ate raw octopus and lupins. He said, "Cosmopolitis imi, I am a citizen of the world." He compared his wanderings through Greece to the migration of storks, north in summer, south to avoid the winter cold. We Lapps have the same nature as the reindeer. In the springtime we long for the mountains. In winter we are drawn to the woods. Turi's Book of Lapland. In ancient India the monsoon made travel impossible, and since the Buddha did not want his followers to wade up to their necks in flood water, he allowed them a rain retreat, the Vasa, During this time the homeless pilgrims were to congregate on higher ground and live in huts of wattle and daub. It was from these sites that the great Buddhist monasteries arose. In the early Christian church there were two kinds of pilgrimage, to wander for God, ambulare pro Deo, in imitation of Christ, or of Father Abraham, who quit the city of Ur and went to live in a tent. The second was the penitential pilgrimage, in which criminals guilty of enormous crimes, peccata enormia, were required, in accordance with a fixed set of tariffs, to assume the role of travelling beggar, with hat, purse, baton and badge, and work out their salvation on the road. The idea that walking dissolved crimes of violence goes back to the wanderings forced on Cain to atone for the murder of his brother. Walata, Mauritania. The camel men wore flaying knives instead of rosaries around their necks and had served as auxiliaries with the legion. At sunset they took me to a house on the edge of town in order to hear the bagi. The bagi was a holy wanderer who would walk from oasis to oasis in the company of his toothless old father. His eyes were clouded blue almonds. He had been blind from birth, and the father had to lead him everywhere. He knew the whole of the Quran by heart, and, when we found him, he was crouched against the mud-brick wall, chanting the surahs with an uplifted smile, while the father turned the pages of the book. The words came faster and faster, until they tailed off into a continuous hammering rhythm, like a drum solo. The father flipped over the pages, and the people in the crowd began to sway with a lost look, as though they were on the verge of trance. Suddenly the buggy stopped. There was a moment of absolute silence. The next verse he began to enunciate very, very slowly, twisting his tongue around the gutturals, flinging the words one by one at the audience, who caught them as messages from out there. The father rested his head against his son's shoulder and let out a deep sigh. "Life is a bridge. Cross over it, but build no house on it," Indian proverb. On the spring migration, province of Fars, between Firuzabad and Shiraz, the Kashgai migration is in full swing. Mile on mile of sheep and goats, like ant trails if you watch them from the hillsides. Hardly a blade of grass, a dusting of green on the mountains, but along the route only a white broom in flower and a grey-leaved artemisia. The animals thin and weak, skin-covered, bone but little more. Now and then one falls out of line, like a soldier fainting on parade, totters and falls. And then it's a race between the vultures and the dogs. Slavering mastiffs, red-headed vultures, but are their heads really red or red with blood? Both. They are both red and blooded, and when you look along the way we've come, there are spirals of vultures wheeling. The Kashgai men were lean, hard-mouthed, weather-beaten, and wore cylindrical caps of white felt. The women were in all their finery, bright calico dresses, bought especially for the springtime journey. Some rode horses and donkeys, some were on camels, along with the tents and tent poles. Their bodies ebbed and flowed to the pitching saddles, their eyes were blinkered to the road ahead. A woman in saffron and green rode by on a black horse. Behind her, bundled up together on the saddle, a child was playing with a motherless lamb. Copper pots were clanking, and there was a rooster tied on with a string. She was also suckling a baby. Her breasts were festooned with necklaces of gold coins and amulets. Like most nomad women, she wore her wealth. What then are a nomad baby's first impressions of this world? A swaying nipple and a shower of gold. The Huns burn with an insatiable lust for gold. Ammianus Marcellinus. For they had golden earrings, because they were Ishmaelites. Judges, chapter 8, verse 24. A good horse is a member of the family, Kashgai saying. Dasht-i-Arjan, near Shiraz. The old man crouched beside his dying chestnut mare. On migration, the horses are the first to drop. He had found a patch of fresh grass. He had coaxed the mare onto it and was trying to ram a handful between her teeth. It was too late. She lay on her side, tongue out, with the glazed eyes of approaching death. The old man bit his lip and cried, sparingly, a drop or two down either cheek. Then he shouldered the saddle without a backward glance, and together we walked to the road. Along the road we were picked up by one of the Khans in his Land Rover. He was a straight-backed old gentleman with a monocle and some knowledge of Europe. He owned a house and orchards in Shiraz, but every spring he put himself on call to help his kin. He took me to a tent, where his fellow Khans were meeting to discuss their strategy. One was a very chic type in a padded yellow ski jacket. He had what I took to be a skier's tan. I suspected him of coming straight from Saint Moritz, and he mistrusted me on sight. The Khan they all deferred to was a wiry, hook-nosed man with a growth of grey stubble on his chin, who sat on a kilim, listening to the others' arguments without moving a muscle. Then he reached for a scrap of paper and on it drew some wiggly lines in ballpoint. This was the order of precedence in which the different clans were to move through the next stretch of country. The same scene is described in Genesis chapter 13, verse 9, when Abraham, the Bedouin sheikh, becomes worried that his cowboys will start fighting with the cowboys of Lot. Is not the whole land before thee? Separate thyself, I pray thee, from me. If thou wilt take the left hand, then I will go to the right. Or if thou depart to the right hand, then I will go to the left. Any nomad migration must be organized with the precision and flexibility of a military campaign. Behind, the grass is shriveling. Ahead, the passes may be blocked with snow. Most nomads claim to their own migration path. In Arabic, ilra, the way. But in practice, they only lay claim to seasonal grazing rights. Time and space are thus dissolved around each other. A month and a stretch of roads are synonymous. But a nomad's migration, unlike that of a hunter, is not his own. It is, rather, a guided tour of animals whose instinctive sense of direction has been blunted by domestication. It calls for skill and risk-taking. A man, like Job, can be ruined in a single season, as were the nomads of the Sahel or the Wyoming cattle companies in the Great White Winter of 1886-7. In a bad season, a nomad's temptation to stray from his path is irresistible, but the army is waiting for him with submachine guns. The army, said my friend the old Khan, has now replaced the lion and the wolf. Nomos is Greek for pasture, and the nomad is a chief or clan elder who presides over the allocation of pastures. Nomos thus came to mean law, fair distribution, that which is allotted by custom, and so the basis of all Western law. The verb nemein, to graze, to pasture, to range, or to spread, has a second sense as early as Homer, to deal, to apportion, or to dispense, especially of land, honour, meat, or drink. Nemesis is the distribution of justice, and so of divine justice. Nomisma means current coin, hence numismatics. The nomads known to Homer were the mare-milking Scythians, who roamed with their wagons across the South Russian steppe. They were a people who buried their chiefs under grave mounds, with horses and treasures of gold. But the origins of nomadism are very hard to assess. Bandiagara, Mali. Madame Ditalen, an old Africa hand, gave me coffee in her caravan on the edge of the Dogon Cliff. I asked her what traces the Bororo Pool, cattle herders of the Sahel, would leave for an archaeologist once they had moved off a campsite. She thought for a moment and answered, "They scatter the ashes of their fires." No, your archaeologist would not find those, but the women do weave little chaplets from grass stems and hang them from the branch of their shade tree. Max Weber traces the origins of modern capitalism to certain Calvinists, who, disregarding the parable of the camel and the eye of the needle, preached the doctrine of the just rewards of work. Yet the concept of shifting and increasing one's wealth on the hoof has a history as old as herding itself. Domesticated animals are currency, things that run, from the French courir. In fact, almost all our monetary expressions, capital, stock, pecuniary, chattel, sterling, perhaps even the idea of growth itself, have their origins in the pastoral world. Is it not passing brave to be a king, and ride in triumph through Persepolis? Marlowe, Tamburlaine the Great, Part 1, Scene 1, Line 758. Persepolis, Fars. We were walking to Persepolis in the rain. The Kashgai were soaked and happy, and the animals were soaked, and when the rain let up they shook the water from their coats and moved on as though they were dancing. We passed an orchard with a mud wall around it. There was a smell of orange blossom after rain. A boy was walking beside me. He and a girl exchanged a flashing glance. She was riding behind her mother on a camel, but the camel was moving faster. About 3 miles short of Persepolis, we came to some huge domed tents under construction, to which the Shah-i-Shah had invited a riff-raff of royalty for his coronation in June. The tents were designed by the Paris firm of decorators, Janssen. Someone was yelling, in French. I tried to get the Kashgai boy to comment, or even to look at the tents, but he shrugged and looked the other way, and so we went on to Persepolis. Passing Persepolis, I looked at the fluted columns, the porticos, lions, bulls, griffins, the sleek metallic finish of the stone, and the line on line of megalomaniac inscription. I, the king, burned, slew, settled. My sympathies were with Alexander for burning it. Again I tried to get the Kashgai boy to look. Again he shrugged. Persepolis might have been made of matchsticks for all he knew or cared. And so we went up to the mountains. Pyramids, arches, obelisks were but the irregularities of vain glory and wild enormities of ancient magnanimity. Sir Thomas Browne, Urna Burial. London. Franco S., returning from Iran for the first time since the fall of the Shah, says that, among the side effects of the Khomeini Revolution, the Kashgai have recovered their strength and their mobility. The tradition of the campfire faces that of the pyramid. Martin Buber, Moses. Before addressing the crowds at the Nuremberg rallies, the Führer would commune with himself in a subterranean chamber modelled on the tomb in the Great Pyramid. Look, I've drawn a skull on top of the pyramid. Why did you do that, Sadik? I like drawing scary things. What's the skull doing on the pyramid? Because a giant's buried in there and his skull's popping out. What do you think of that giant? Bad. Why? Because he eats people up. Conversation with Sadiq el-Fadil el-Mahdi, aged 6. Jadwe's horror of hewn masonry, and if thou wilt make me an altar of stone, thou shalt not build it of hewn stone, for if thou lift up thy tool upon it, thou hast polluted it. Exodus chapter 20, verse 25. But no man knoweth of his sepulchre unto this day. Deuteronomy chapter 34, verse 6. In the last of the moonlight, a dog howls and falls silent, the firelight flutters and the watchman yawns, a very old man walks silently past the tents, feeling his way with a stick to make sure he doesn't trip on the tent ropes. He walks on. His people are moving to a greener country. Moses has an appointment with the jackals and vultures. Pompey in Jerusalem, after barging his way into the temple, demanded to be shown the Holy of Holies, and was surprised to find himself in an empty room. Herodotus records the visit of some Greeks to Egypt, who, on seeing the man-made mountains of limestone, called them pyramids, because their shape reminded them of little wheaten cakes that were sold on street stalls. He adds that the local inhabitants preserved a memory of their construction as a time of horror, and were unable to pronounce the names of the builders, Cheops and Khephren, preferring to call them Philitis, after the name of a shepherd who had once pastured his flock in their shadow. Masonry. And is it man's? I shudder at the thought of the ancient Egyptians. Herman Melville, Journey Up the Straits. Jingwerber Mosque, Timbuktu. Row on row of gloomy mud-brick arches. Bat guano. Wasps' nests in the rafters. Shafts of sunlight falling on reed mats like the beams of a burning glass. The marabout interrupted his prayers to ask me a few questions.
"There is a people called the Americans?" he asked. "There is. They say they have visited the moon."
"They have?"
"They are blasphemers."
A very short history of the skyscraper. Everyone knows that the Tower of Babel was conceived as an attack on heaven. The officials in charge of the construction were few, the workforce was innumerable, and in order that commands might not be misconstrued, every worker was required to speak the same language. Little by little, as the courses of masonry succeeded one another, the highest authority became anxious that the concept of a war against heaven might be meaningless. Worse, that God in his heaven might not exist. At an emergency session of the Central Committee, it was decided to launch a probe into the sky. Salvos of missiles were fired off, vertically, and when these returned to Earth blood-stained, here was proof that God, after all, was mortal, and that work on the tower should proceed. He, for his part, resented being pricked in the backside. One morning, with a disdainful puff, he unsteadied the arm of a mason on one of the uppermost terraces, causing him to drop a brick onto the head of a fellow mason below. It was an accident. Everyone knew it was an accident, but the mason below began shouting threats and insults. His comrades tried to calm him, in vain. Everyone took sides in the quarrel, without knowing what the quarrel was about. Everyone, in his righteous anger, refused to listen to what his neighbor was saying and used language intended to confuse. The Central Committee was helpless, and the work gangs, each of whom now spoke a different language, took refuge from each other in remotest regions of the earth. After Josephus, Jewish Antiquities, chapter 1, verse 4. Without compulsion, no settlement could be founded. The workers would have no supervisor. The rivers would not bring the overflow. Sumerian text. To the Babylonian, Bab-il meant gate of God. To the Hebrews, the same word meant confusion, perhaps cacophonous confusion. The ziggurats of Mesopotamia were gates of God, painted the seven colors of the rainbow, and dedicated to Anu and Enlil, divinities representing order and compulsion. It was surely a marvelous intuition on the part of the ancient Jews, sandwiched as they were between bullying empires, to have conceived the state as behemoth or leviathan, as a monster which threatened human life. They were perhaps the first people to understand that the tower was chaos, that order was chaos, and that language, the gift of tongues which Yahweh breathed into the mouth of Adam, has a rebellious and wayward vitality, compared to which the foundations of the pyramid are as dust. On the train, Frankfurt to Vienna. He was on his way to see his old father, who was a rabbi in Vienna. He was short and fat. He had pallid white skin and ginger ringlets, and wore a long serge greatcoat and beaver hat. He was very shy. He was so shy he found it impossible to undress with anyone else in the compartment. The sleeping car attendant had assured him he would be alone. I offered to go into the corridor. The train was passing through a forest. I opened the window and breathed in the smell of pines. When I came back, 10 minutes later, he was lying on the upper bunk, relaxed and eager to talk. For 16 years he had been studying at the Talmudic Academy in Brooklyn. He had not seen his father since. The morning would reunite them. Before the war, his family had lived at Sibiu in Romania, and when the war came, they hoped they were safe. Then in 1942, Nazis painted a star on their house. The rabbi shaved his beard and cut his ringlets. His Gentile servant fetched him a peasant costume, a felt hat, a belted tunic, a sheepskin jacket and boots. He embraced his wife, his two daughters, and the baby boy. All four of them would die in Birkenau. He took his firstborn son in his arms and dashed for the woods. The rabbi walked through the Carpathian beech forest with his son. Shepherds sheltered them and gave them meat. The way the shepherds slaughtered sheep did not offend his principles. Eventually they crossed the Turkish frontier and made their way to America. The rabbi never felt at ease in America. He could sympathize with Zionism, but never bring himself to join. Israel was an idea, not a country. Wherever was the Torah, there was the kingdom also. He had left in despair for Europe. Now father and son were returning to Romania since, only a few weeks earlier, the rabbi had received a sign. Late one night in his apartment in Vienna, he reluctantly answered the doorbell. On the landing stood an old woman with a shopping basket. She had bluish lips and wispy white hair. Dimly, he recognized his Gentile servant. "I have found you," she said. "Your house is safe. Your books are safe. Your clothes even. For years I pretended it was now a Gentile house. I am dying. Here is the key." Shakhrak, Afghanistan. The Tajiks say they are the oldest people in the land. They plant wheat, flax, and melons. They have long, resigned faces and exhaust themselves in tending irrigation ditches. They keep fighting partridges and do not know how to look after horses. In the valley above the Tajik village, we came to a camp of Virushkui Aymaks. Their yurts had domed white roofs, and the sides were painted with lozenges, scrolls, and checkers in every conceivable colour, like a field of chivalry. Horses were grazing in a meadow of cornflowers, and there were white-leaved willows along the stream. We saw a fat-tailed sheep with a tail so big it had to be strapped to a cart. Outside the yurts, some women in purple were carding wool. This is the time of year when the farmers and nomads, after a season of acrimony, are suddenly the best of friends. The harvest is in, the nomads buy grain for the winter, the villagers buy cheese and hides and meat. They welcome the sheep onto their fields to break up the stubble and manure it for autumn planting. Nomad and planter are the twin arms of the so-called Neolithic Revolution, which, in its classic form, took place around 8,500 BC on the slopes of the Fertile Crescent, the well-watered land of hills and valleys that stretches in an arc from Palestine to southwestern Iran. Here, at altitudes of 3,000 feet or so, the wild ancestors of our sheep and goats would browse over stands of wild wheat and barley. Gradually, as each of these four species was domesticated, the farmers spread downhill onto the alluvial floodplains from which the first cities would arise. The herdsmen, for their part, took to the summer uplands and founded a rival order of their own. The Amorite, who knows not grain, a people whose onslaught is like a hurricane, a people who have never known a city. Sumerian text. Wisa, mountains of air, Niger. The garden was circular, its soil was black. Around the perimeter ran a palisade of thorn bush to keep away the camels and goats. At the center stood two ancient date palms flanking the well shaft and a tank. Four irrigation ditches divided the garden into quarters. The quarters were further divided into a maze of vegetable beds and planted with peas, beans, onions, carrots, greens, squashes, and tomatoes. The gardener was a Negro slave, naked but for a breech clout. He was lost in concentration on his work. He would heave the leather bucket up the shaft and watch the water threading round the labyrinth. When one crop had had its fill, he would dam up the channel with his hoe and divert the current onto the next patch. A short way up the valley, there were other circular palisades of thorn into which the Tuareg drove their goats at night. The Negro, in command of his seedlings, shares a common destiny with the first dictators. Sumerian and Egyptian archives tell us that the earliest rulers of civilization saw themselves as lords of the fertilizing waters who would either bring life to their wilting subjects or turn the taps off. Abel, in whose death the church fathers saw the martyrdom of Christ prefigured, was a keeper of sheep. Cain was a settled farmer. Abel was the favorite of God, because Yahweh himself was a god of the way, whose restlessness precluded other gods. Yet Cain, who would build the first city, was promised dominion over him. A verse of the Midrash, commenting on the quarrel, says that the sons of Adam inherited an equal division of the world, Cain the ownership of all land, Abel of all living creatures, whereupon Cain accused Abel of trespass. the names of the brothers are a matched pair of opposites. Abel comes from the Hebrew Hebel, meaning breath or vapor, anything that lives and moves and is transient, including his own life. The root of Cain appears to be the verb kana, to acquire, get, own property, and so rule or subjugate. Cain also means metalsmith, and since in several languages, even Chinese, the words for violence and subjugation are linked to the discovery of metal, it is perhaps the destiny of Cain and his descendants to practice the black arts of technology. A possible synopsis for the murder. Cain is a painstaking fellow, bent double from constant digging. The day is hot and cloudless. Eagles are floating high above in the blue. The last of the snowmelt still cascades down the valley, but the hillsides are already brown and parched. Flies cluster at the corners of his eyes. He wipes the sweat from his forehead and resumes his work. His hoe has a wooden handle with a stone blade hafted onto it. Somewhere higher up the slope, Abel is resting in the cool of a rock. He trills at his flute, again and again the same insistent trills. Cain pauses to listen. Stiffly he straightens his back. Then, raising his hand against the glare, he peers at his fields along the stream. The sheep have trampled his morning's work. Without having time to think, he breaks into a run. A less excusable version of the story says that Cain lay in ambush for Abel and heaved a rock onto his head, in which case the killing was the fruit of brewed-up bitterness and envy, the envy of the prisoner for the freedom of open spaces. Yahweh allows Cain to make atonement only if he pays the price. He denies him the fruits of the earth and forces him to wander a fugitive and a vagabond in the land of Nod, Nod meaning wilderness or desert, where Abel once wandered before him. Travel, same word as travail, bodily or mental labor, toil, especially of a painful or oppressive nature, exertion, hardship, suffering, a journey. Cain's city built with human blood, not blood of bulls and goats. William Blake, The Ghost of Abel. Alone and amid the nations, masters of the raid, avid for increase, yet disgusted by possessions, driven by the fantasy of all travellers to pine for a stable home, no people but the Jews have ever felt more keenly the moral ambiguities of settlement. Their God is a projection of their perplexity. Their book, the Old Testament and the New, may be read, on one level at least, as a monumental dialogue between him and his people in the rights and wrongs of living in the land. Was it to be a land for fields and houses, a land of corn and wine, of cities which they had not built and vineyards which they did not plant? Or was it to be a country of black tent and goat path, a nomad's country of milk and wild honey, a kingdom where the people may dwell in a place of their own and move no more? 2 Samuel chapter 7, verse 10. Or was it, as Heine surmised, a portable kingdom, which could only exist in men's hearts? Yahweh, in origin, is a god of the way. His sanctuary is the mobile ark, his house a tent, his altar a cairn of rough stones. And though he may promise his children a well-watered land, as blue and green are a Bedouin's favourite colours, he secretly desires for them the desert. He leads them out of Egypt, away from the fleshpots and the overseer's lash, a journey of 3 days into the harsh, clean air of Sinai. There he gives them their solemn feast, the Passover, a feast of roasted lamb and bitter herbs, of bread baked not in an oven but on a hot stone, and he commands them to eat it in haste, with shodden feet and sticks in hand, to remind them for ever that their vitality lies in movement. He gives them their ring dance, the hag, a dance that mimes the antics of goats on their spring migration, as when one goeth with a pipe into the mountains of the Lord. He appears in the burning bush and in the pillar of fire. He is everything that Egypt is not. Yet he will allow himself the doubtful honour of a temple and regret it. They have set their abominations in the house which is called by my name to pollute it. Jeremiah chapter 7, verse 30. The ghettos of Eastern Europe were each a little patch of desert, where no green thing would grow. Jews were forbidden by their Christian masters to own land or houses, to grow their own vegetables, or practice any trade but usury. And though they were allowed to gather sticks for firewood, they might not saw a plank, in case this led to building. The Gentiles, who imposed these restrictions, believed they were punishing the Jews for the crime of killing Christ, as Yahweh had punished Cain. Orthodox Jews believed that by accepting them, they were reliving the journey through Sinai, when the people had found favor with their Lord. The prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Amos, and Hosea, were nomadic revivalists, who howled abuse at the decadence of civilization. By sinking roots in the land, by laying house to house and field to field, by turning the temple into a sculpture gallery, the people had turned from their God. How long, O Lord, how long, until the cities be wasted? The prophets looked to a day of restoration, when the Jews would return to the frugal asceticism of nomadic life. In the vision of Isaiah, they are promised a Saviour, whose name will be Emmanuel, and who would be a herdsman. When Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had the Jews penned up behind the walls of Jerusalem, Jeremiah reminded them of the Rechabites, the only tribe to have resisted the blandishments of settled life. "We will drink no wine, for Jonadab, the son of Rechab, our father, commanded us, saying, Ye shall drink no wine, neither ye nor your sons forever. Neither shall ye build house, nor sow seed, nor plant vineyard, nor have any, but all your days ye shall dwell in tents, that ye may live many days in the land where ye be strangers." Jeremiah chapter 35, verses 6 to 7. The Rechabites alone, by preserving tactical mobility, would escape the horrors of siege warfare. In the Muqaddimah, or Universal History, of Ibn Khaldun, a philosopher who surveyed the human condition from a nomadic viewpoint, we read, "The desert people are closer to being good than settled peoples, because they are closer to the first state, and are more removed from all the evil habits that have infected the hearts of settlers." By desert people, Ibn Khaldun means the Bedouin, such as those he once recruited as mercenaries from the heart of the Sahara in the days of his warlike youth. Years later, when he had gazed into the slanting eyes of Tamerlane and witnessed the piles of skulls and smouldering cities, he too, like the Old Testament prophets, felt the fearful anxiety of civilization and looked back with longing to life in the tents. Ibn Khaldun based his system on the intuition that men decline, morally and physically, as they drift towards cities. The rigors of the desert, he suggested, had preceded the softness of cities. The desert was thus a reservoir of civilization, and desert peoples had the advantage over settlers because they were more abstemious, freer, braver, healthier, less bloated, less craven, less liable to submit to rotten laws, and altogether easier to cure. Monastery of Simonas Petras, Mount Athos. A young Hungarian, exhausted after climbing the holy mountain, came and sat on the balcony and stared at the stormy sea below. He had trained as an epidemiologist, but had given up this work in order to climb the sacred mountains of the world. He hoped to climb Mount Ararat and to circumambulate Mount Kailash in Tibet. "Man," he said suddenly, without warning, "was not meant to settle down." This was something he had learnt from his study of epidemics. The story of infectious disease was a story of men brewing in their own filth. He also made the observation that Pandora's box of ills had been a Neolithic pottery urn. "Make no mistake," he said, "epidemics are going to make nuclear weapons seem like useless toys." Hong Kong. Paddy Booz tells of meeting a Taoist Grand Master on the streets of a provincial Chinese city. The man was wearing his Grand Master's blue robes and high hat. He and his young disciple had walked the length and breadth of China. "But what," Paddy asked him, "did you do during the Cultural Revolution?" "I went for a walk in the Kunlun Mountains." Driving with Arkady, I remembered a passage in Vernadsky's Early Russia, which describes how Slav peasants would submerge themselves in a marsh, breathing through hollow reeds until the sound of the horsemen died away. "Come home and meet my dad," he said.
He and his mates did that when the panzers came through the village. Quadrupedante putrum sonitu quatit ungula campum. Virgil's exemplary hexameter, to describe the thud of horse hooves over a plain, has its Persian equivalent in the utterance of a survivor from the Mongol sack of Bukhara. Amdant, ukundant, usoktant, ukushtant, uburdant, uraftant. They came and they sapped and they burned and they slew and they trussed up their loot and were gone. In his History of the World Conqueror, Uvaini says that all his writing and all the horror of those times is contained in this one line. From Henry Yule's Marco Polo, Chapter 1, Line 233, on the cruelty of nomads. I do not have a mill with willow trees. I have a horse and a whip. I will kill you and go. Yomut Turkoman. In 1223, the Novgorod Chronicle recorded the arrival from Tartary of a sorceress and two men with her, who demanded one-tenth of everything, of men, princes, horses, treasure, of everything one-tenth. The Russian princes said no. The Mongol invasion was on. Leningrad. A picnic in the office of a professor of archaeology. Caviar, black bread, slabs of smoked sturgeon, onions, radishes, and a bottle of Solchinaya for two. For most of the morning I had been canvassing his views on the mechanics of nomad invasions. Toynbee held to the theory that a phase of drought somewhere on the Central Asian steppe would dislodge a tribe from its grazing grounds and cause a house of cards effect with ripples from Europe to China. It had struck me, however, that nomads were at their most invasive, not in times of want, but abundance. In times of maximum growth, when the grass was greenest, and the herdsmen allowed their stock to increase beyond the point of stability. As for the professor, his nomads seemed to have moved in nice, tight, obedient circles, without troubling their neighbours or trespassing on what are now the boundaries of the socialist republics. Later, after a few more shots of vodka, he enfolded me in a fraternal, pan-European embrace, and pushing the corners of his eyes into a pair of slits, said, "What we hate is this, isn't it?" "Not me," I said. Le désert est monothéiste. Renan's aphorism implies that blank horizons and a dazzling sky will clear the mind of its distractions and allow it to concentrate on the Godhead. But life in the desert is not like that. To survive at all, the desert dweller, Tuareg or Aboriginal, must develop a prodigious sense of orientation. He must forever be naming, sifting, comparing a thousand different signs, the tracks of a dung beetle or the ripple of a dune, to tell him where he is, where the others are, where rain has fallen, where the next meal is coming from, whether if plant X is in flower, plant Y will be in berry, and so forth. It is a paradox of the monotheistic faiths that, although they arose within the ambit of the desert people themselves show an indifference towards the Almighty that is decidedly cavalier. "We will go up to God and salute him," said a Bedou to Palgrave in the 1860s, "and if he proves hospitable, we will stay with him. If otherwise, we will mount our horses and ride off." Muhammad said, "No man becomes a prophet who was not first a shepherd." But, as he had to confess, the Arabs of the desert were the most hardened in infidelity and hypocrisy. Until recently, a Bedouin who migrated within sight of Mecca would not think it worthwhile, even once in a lifetime, to circumambulate the shrines. Yet the Hajj, or sacred journey, was itself a ritual migration, to detach men from their sinful homes and reinstate, if temporarily, the equality of all men before God. A pilgrim on the Hajj has resumed man's first condition. If he dies on the Hajj, he goes straight as a martyr to heaven. Similarly, Ilra, the way, was first used as a technical term for road or migration path before being adopted by the mystics to denote the way to God. The concept has its equivalent in the Central Australian languages, where Cherna Jugurba means the footprints of the ancestor and the way of the law.
It would seem there exists, at some deep level of the human psyche, a connection between pathfinding and law. To the Arabian Bedouin, hell is a sunlit sky, and the sun a strong, bony female, mean, old, and jealous of life, who shrivels the pastures and the skin of humans. The moon, by contrast, is a lithe and energetic young man, who guards the nomad while he sleeps, guides him on night journeys, brings rain, and distills the dew on plants. He has the misfortune to be married to the sun. He grows thin and wasted after a single night with her. It takes him a month to recover. The Norwegian anthropologist Frederick Barth writes of how the Baseri, another tribe of Iranian nomads, were, in the 1930s, forbidden by Reza Shah to move from their winter grazing ground. In 1941, the Shah was deposed, and they were free once again to make the 300-mile journey to the Zagros. Free they were, but they had no animals. Their fine fleeced sheep had suffocated on the southern plains, yet they set off all the same. They became nomads again, which is to say, they became human again. The supreme value to them, wrote Barth, lay in the freedom to migrate, not in the circumstances that make it economically viable. When Barth came to account for the dearth of ritual among the Baseri, or of any rooted belief, he concluded that the journey itself was the ritual, that the road to summer uplands was the way, and that the pitching and dismantling of tents were prayers more meaningful than any in the mosque. Raids are our agriculture. Bedouin proverb. I against my brother, I and my brother against our cousin, I my brother and our cousin against the neighbours, all of us against the foreigner. Bedouin proverb. Alois Musil, the Arabist cousin of Robert, calculated in 1928 that among the Rowala Bedouin, four-fifths of the men fell in war or vendettas or died from wounds received. Hunters, on the other hand, who practice an art of the minimum, deliberately limit their numbers and enjoy far greater security of life and land. Of the Central Australian native, Spencer and Gillen wrote that, though he might occasionally quarrel or fight, the idea of annexing fresh territory would never enter his head, an attitude to be explained by the belief that his Alkaringa, Dreamtime, ancestors occupied precisely the same country as he does now. The pastoral ethic in Australia? Someone in the Department of Aboriginal Affairs, I think it was the minister himself, has said that in the Northern Territory, foreign-owned cattle have more rights than Australian citizens. The pastoral ethic in ancient Ireland? Since I took my spear in my hand, I have not been without killing a Connaught man every single day. Conall Chernach, an Ulster cattleman. Any nomad tribe is a military machine in embryo, whose impulse, if it is not fighting other nomads, is to raid or threaten the city. Settlers, therefore, since the beginning of history, have recruited nomads as mercenaries, either to stave off a nomad threat, as the Cossacks fought the Tartars for the Tsars, or, if there were no nomads, to fight other states. In ancient Mesopotamia, these mercenaries first transformed themselves into a caste of military aristocrats, then into directors of the state. It can be argued that the state, as such, resulted from a kind of chemical fusion between herdsman and planter, once it was realized that the techniques of animal coercion could be applied to an inert peasant mass. Apart from their role as lords of the fertilizing waters, the first dictators called themselves shepherds of the people. Indeed, all over the world, the words for slave and domesticated animal are the same. The masses are to be corralled, milked, penned in, to save them from the human wolves outside, and, if need be, lined up for slaughter. The city is thus a sheepfold superimposed over a garden. A further possibility, not without application to the games theory of warfare, is that the army, any professional army or war department, is, without knowing it, a tribe of surrogate nomads, which has grown up inside the state, which preys off the state, without whom the state would crumble, yet whose restlessness is, finally, destructive of the state in that, like gadflies, They are forever trying to goad it into action. Hesiod's Works and Days provides a metaphorical model for the decline of man in relation to technological progress. His stages of human culture pass from the ages of gold to those of silver, bronze, and iron. The Bronze and Iron Ages were an archaeological reality which Hesiod knew from experience, and which had culminated in a crescendo of violence and strife. Obviously, he was unaware of Paleolithic and Neolithic, so the Gold and Silver Ages were conceived symbolically. Arranged in the reverse order of metallic perfection, they represent a degeneration from the incorruptible to the tarnished, the corroded, and the rusty. The men of the golden race, Hesiod says, lived in an age when Cronus, or natural time, ruled in heaven. The earth provided them with abundance. They lived happy, carefree lives, wandering freely over their lands, without possessions, houses, or war. They ate their meals in common with one another and the immortal gods. They died with hands and feet unfailing, as if sleep had come upon them. In the Christian era, Origen, contra Celsum, 479, would use Hesiod's text to argue that at the beginning of human history, men were under supernatural protection, so there was no division between their divine and human natures. Or to rephrase the passage, there was no contradiction between a man's instinctual life and his reason. In the part of Libya where the wild beasts are found, live the Garamantes, who avoid all intercourse with men, possess no weapons of war, and do not know how to defend themselves. Herodotus, chapter 4, line 194. Early Christians believed that by returning to the desert they could assume our Lord's agony in the wilderness. They wander in the deserts as if they were wild animals themselves. Like birds, they fly about the hills. They forage like beasts. Their daily round is inflexible, always predictable, for they feed on roots, the natural product of the earth. From the spiritual meadow of St. John Moschus, a description of hermits known as the Browsers. Every mythology remembers the innocence of the first state, Adam in the garden, the peaceful Hyperboreans, the Utarakurus, or the men of perfect virtue of the Taoists. Pessimists often interpret the story of the Golden Age as a tendency to turn our backs on the ills of the present and sigh for the happiness of youth. But nothing in Hesiod's text exceeds the bounds of probability. The real or half-real tribes which hover on the fringe of ancient geographies, Atavantes, Feni, Parasites, or the dancing spermatophagi, have their modern equivalents in the Bushman, the Shoshonian, the Eskimo, and the Aboriginal. One characteristic of the men of the Golden Age, they are always remembered as migratory. On the coast of Mauritania, not far from where the Méduse of Géricault's Radeau de la Méduse was wrecked, I saw the flimsy shelters of the Imraguen, a caste of fishermen who catch mullet in seine nets and enjoy, with cheerfulness and grace, the same pariah status as the Namadi. Similar fishermen's huts will have stood on the shore of Lake Galilee. Come with me, and I will make you fishers of men. An alternative to the vision of the Golden Age is that of the anti-primitivists, who believe that man, in becoming a hunter, became the hunter and killer of his kind. This is a very convenient doctrine if, A, you wish to murder others, B, you wish to take draconian measures to prevent their murderous impulses from getting out of hand. Whichever way, the savage must be seen as vile. In his Meditations on Hunting, Ortega y Gasset makes the point that hunting, unlike violence, is never reciprocal. The hunter hunts and the hunted tries to escape. A leopard at the kill is no more violent or angry than an antelope is angry with the grass it eats. Most accounts of the hunters emphasize that the act of killing is a moment of compassion and reverence, of gratitude to the animal that consents to die. A bushy in the pub at Glenarmond turned to me and said, "Want to know how the blackfellows hunt? Tell me." "Instinct,"